Well, Christ Church is a strategic partner of Grace Chapel in Lexington. So if you're here on an average Sunday, you'll hear streamed preaching live from Pastor Brian Wilkerson. We've been blessed to have him really a part of our congregation, and I'm connecting with him and their staff every week. But from time to time, when Brian's not preaching or they're doing something very special at Grace, as they are this weekend, you'll hear from yours truly. Your pastor. So today we are going to talk a little bit about David and Goliath. But before we get there, back in 1980, there was a pastor who moved from Texas to California, and he had a burning desire to be a church planter and plant a church. So he just started out with a small group in his home, and they prayed, and they thought, how can we reach this community? How can we build a church in this area? So he decided that he would go ahead and start a letter campaign. But he wanted to craft his letter as perfectly as he could. So he did research, and he read over it time and time again until he could get the perfect letter. And he crafted his letter, and he recruited his home group. And over the next few days, they stuffed 15,000 envelopes to send throughout the area. 15,000 envelopes. And on the Sunday that they started, they had 60 people show up. But those 60 people turned into the 20,000 people that attend Saddleback Church today. Now, we want to be successful. As a church, we want to experience growth. We want to experience not just numerical growth, but spiritual growth and emotional and relational growth. It's really part of the American ethos, success and prosperity. Success and prosperity can be a bad thing too, but as far as the church, we should look at it as a positive thing. If we go about it in the right way, success should be a good thing. We don't want to decline in numbers. We don't want to decline spiritually. But sometimes it just feels like everything is going against us. Whether it's in the church, whether it's in our families, whether it's in our individual relationships with our friends. As people of the church, we look around and we say, Jesus doesn't seem to really be relevant to this culture anymore. At least that's how they perceive it. People don't really care about church or Christianity. How can we possibly make an impact in this culture? Or sometimes in our relationships with our spouses. Well, we want to have a successful marriage. Everybody hopes that they will when they enter into marriage. But sometimes we look at our spouse and we say, whoa, I didn't expect that to happen. I didn't expect him to say that. Is this the person that I married? What's going on? Is this true in our parenting relationships and really all of our relationships? We struggle. We experience these roadblocks. We want to be the kind of people that God prospers. And we look in the Bible and we see that there were a lot of people in the Bible that failed, but we also look at the Bible and we see that there were a lot of people that seemed to be really successful and had things just go their way. And what frustrates us even more is sometimes we look at our Christian friends and we look at them and sure they suffer and sure they go through trials and struggles, but they just seem to handle life with a lot of grace. And they seem to just have a lot of success in their life. What's their secret? Is it the cologne that they're wearing, like the advertisements want to tell us? Well, maybe it's the translation of the Bible that they're reading. I should really dump that modern translation and go back to the KJV. That'll fix all of my problems. What's the secret to success? We want success, but it's difficult. Now let me clarify from the get-go, this is not a health and wealth sermon. You won't hear that from me. The Bible teaches that we will suffer. And it teaches us that we will be persecuted if we live for Jesus. That's the reality. But God doesn't just want to drag us through the mud in this life. Sometimes we get that impression too, that this life is supposed to be as bad as it possibly can if I'm a Christian. And that's not true. And in Mark chapter 10, 29 and 30, Jesus promises that if we abandon our lives to Him, we talked about this several weeks ago, if we abandon our lives to Him, we will experience blessings in the life to come, yes, but we'll also experience blessings in this life along with persecution. He adds that in there, yeah. So success in this life is, it's not a bad thing. It's something that we should want as Christians. Well, to be the kind of person to prosper, we need to be the kind of people that God prospers. To prosper, we need to be the kind of people that God prospers. And God is going to show us what kind of person He prospers in 1 Samuel chapter 17. But before we go there, let's talk about the problem just a little bit more. See, the problem is that we kind of get caught up. We get caught up in the surface things. We get caught up in the surface things with church. We tend to think about facilities. You know, if we only have a nicer facility, people will come and they'll learn about Jesus. Or we think a lot about the worship style. We all know that churches have split and fractured, and there's been virtual civil wars in churches because somebody added a guitar or took a piano away, right? And the key demographic that churches tend to be going after these days are millennials. And they're going after millennials because millennials are going away. So they sometimes think we need to have a young and hip pastor if we're going to reach the next generation. Well, I may be younger, but I'm not the other. The only time I put on skinny jeans, I just about tore them. I think Carhartt is cool, not Calvin Klein. And I do have a pair of hipster glasses, but I only wear them when I take my contacts out because I can't see like my hand in front of my face. It's just like, you don't got a hip pastor. But you know what the good news is? The good news is there's been some research and studies and churches that have the 250 churches that have been most successful about reaching people that age. And really, it's not the facilities. The facilities, some are bad, some are good in these churches. It's surprisingly not even the style of worship. Yes, they lean towards being more contemporary, but some are a little bit more classical and traditional. And it's not the youth of the pastor. Some of these pastors are 70 and 80 years old. Isn't that crazy? And not very hip at all. Like me. What's the common trait in all those? I'm not going to tell you now, but we'll get to that in just a minute. But we have a superficial way of looking at things and at people. And it's true in our marriages. It's true in our relationships as well. A father might think he's being a good husband and a good parent because he works all the time. And then he goes home and he's frustrated because his kids and his wife are frustrated at him. And he's thinking, what? Don't I provide for you? I paid for your car. I paid for your college. And so on and so forth. But it's a little bit of a superficial way of looking at being a good husband and a good father. Or a wife might do everything she can to maintain her figure and put on all the right clothes and makeup and look good, but she doesn't treat her husband with warmth and kindness. And she wonders, why does he always seem to stay at work all the time? What's going on? That kind of stuff is true with our individual relationships with people too. We look at things superficially, but God does something different. He doesn't look at the outside appearance, right? He looks at the heart. He looks at the heart. When God is looking for the people that He wants to prosper, He looks at the heart, as He did and does in 1 Samuel chapter 17. I'm going to have you turn there with me. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Just a little bit of background on these books. Preachers don't often spend a lot of time in the Old Testament at all, really, but in these books, 1 and 2 Samuel, these were the first records of the kings of Israel. This is the first taste we really get of what was happening during that time when God first rose up kings for the Jews. But it's not a pleasant story, really, actually. Because at the beginning of the book, it starts out with Samuel, the prophet, whom these books are named after. And Samuel was a prophet who spoke God's word, but he also acted like a judge. You see, before this time, Israel was ruled by judges, and not the kind of judges we think of that are like Supreme Court justices or people who determine the law, but the kind of judges who were temporarily raised up as leaders in Israel when Israel needed a leader, either to lead them out into battle or to just get the people right. But why these judges weren't kings is they would go back to doing what they did. There was no permanent army, and their leadership really wasn't permanent. God would just raise them up for a time, and then they would go back to doing what they were doing. And the reason that God did this is God always wanted to be known as Israel's king. You see, God was the king, and he would raise up helpers from time to time. But he never wanted there to be somebody who was permanent, who had all the power focused on him. So what happens at the beginning of 1 Samuel is the people, they say, look at the other nations, and they're thinking, well, Ammon, they have a king, and these guys have a king, and why can't we have a king like the other nations? Well, you see, God, he had always planned for people, to his people, to have a king, but not like the other nations. Not a king who had a permanent standing, not a king who could just tax to his heart's desire. And the reason that God didn't want to do it that way is because there would be no perfect person who could occupy the throne until, what's the Bible answer? Jesus. Right. So these books are tragedies. They're sad. Because the first book is about King Saul, who starts out with a lot of promise. God grants the Israelites their desire to have a king. Saul starts out with promise. He has some victories, but Saul becomes corrupt, and it ends with his death. Second Samuel is about the kingship of David. And we all know David. We know David from David and Goliath. And David is widely recognized as one of the greatest kings of all of Israel. And if you look at some of the other books in the Bible, it portrays David as a really great king. But we all know that David made big mistakes. So in 1 Samuel 13, it calls David a man after God's own heart. But it never calls him that for the rest of the book. Not after his sin with Bathsheba. Not after his sin of counting all of the Israelites. David's kingship, you know, it ended up okay, but it still ended up sadly. His house and his children were divided. His kids were fighting with him. It's a tragedy. It's a sad story. These are sad stories. But at this moment in time, we have a lot of promise with King David. He looks pretty good. In 1 Samuel 16:7. The prophet Samuel, knowing that Saul's days are numbered, goes to anoint a new king, and he goes to the house of Jesse, who is David's dad. And he starts looking at all the brothers, and he points to the first one, and he thinks, this must be the one. And what does God say? In 1 Samuel 16:7, he says this, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I've rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. The Lord looks at the heart. So Eliab, David's oldest brother, he must have been handsome. He must have been tall. And Samuel's like, that's the guy. And God's like, nope, it's David. It's David. The man with the right heart, the person, the people with the right heart are the kind of people God prospers. What does it mean to have the right heart? We're going to see that in 1 Samuel 17, the story of David and Goliath. So turn with me, please, to 1 Samuel 17. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes, Damim, between Socah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle lines to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He was tall. with this cubits, it ends up being about 9 feet. But interestingly enough, and the Bible doesn't often tell us about how people looked, maybe because of 1 Samuel 16:7, but Hebrew literature just isn't that interested in telling us how people look. So when the Bible tells us how a person looked, it's drawing our attention to something. Well, who else was tall? David's brother Eliab was tall. But somebody else was tall too. King Saul, it says in 1 Samuel 9:2, was a head taller than all the rest of the Israelites. But what were these guys doing? They were shaking in their boots. These were the tall guys that everybody would have expected would have gone out against Goliath, but they were the ones that weren't. Goliath had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels on his legs. He wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out? Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. Before I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistines said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. They were shaking in their boots. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abimadad, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistines came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines." Early in the morning, David left the flock in care of a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As they were talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give him great wealth to this man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." Doesn't that sound nice? No more taxes. And David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. Now when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now what have I done? Said David. Can I even speak? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. We're going to stop there for a second. Notice verse 28. There we have David's oldest brother. Remember David's oldest brother from 1 Samuel 16:7? He was the one that Samuel said, I want that guy to be king. And God said, nope, I have rejected him because I don't look at the outward appearance. I look at his heart. I look at his heart. And what's Eliab saying to David here? He's saying, David, you're wicked. You came down just because you wanted a free show. You left the sheep. What are you doing? The first misconception about David from his outward appearance was that he had the wrong motives, that he was there for the wrong reason. But David was there for the right reasons. He was there to serve his brothers. And the reason that he was interested in fighting Goliath was because, well, he heard about probably the free taxes for his family and was interested in helping his family. But also later on, we learn that he wants to vindicate the name of the Lord, whom Goliath is defying. David is there for the right reasons. The misconception is that he was the one there for the wrong reasons. There's some irony that his brother Eliab is the one making the accusation. Let's look at the next couple verses. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he has been a warrior from youth. But David said to Saul, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from his mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. The second misconception that we have here is Saul looked at his youth and presumed that David was unprepared. He looked at his outward appearance and he assumed, you know what? No way. David has done this, or Goliath has done this a long time. David has no chance here. But what do we learn about David? We learn that he fought and killed bears, one of them at least with his bare hands. He was a shepherd, but he was prepared to do this. He had experience. God had given him experiences that shaped him into be a person who could battle against Goliath despite his youth. He was well prepared. Let's look at this last section together. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he wasn't used to them. I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistines, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was a little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come out to attack me with sticks? Looking at his shepherd's staff. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and to the wild animals." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it was not by the sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into your hands." As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking his stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. We tend to read this story a little bit differently than it actually is. I heard an amazing story last weekend from Mark Kroll. He gave me permission to share about how he got his two front teeth knocked out when you were a kid, right, Mark? Yeah, Mark's over there. You can watch him while I tell this story. So Mark was a boy at summer camp, and you're starting to get these pictures in your mind. Well, maybe he was playing football with some kids, and he was running, and somebody put their elbow up, and he jammed him in the face, and that's how his teeth went out. Or maybe you're thinking of something like one of those giant jungle gyms, those death traps that we used to have as a kid that they don't have anymore. You know, they have the big plastic ones now. But maybe you're picturing a little Mark kind of crawling up there and falling to his face and knocking his teeth out or something like that. Well, that's not what happened, right? No, that's not what happened. So some boys were kind of going after Mark, and you had some other friends with you, right? And they wanted to get Mark wet. So I imagine there was a bucket or something. There was a bucket. Okay, there was a bucket. They're just trying to get Mark wet. So Mark and his friends find some shelter inside of a tent where they waited. And the boys, they didn't want them inside the tent. They wanted them outside the tent so that they could get them wet. So they decided to pick up stones, throw it at the tent to get them out. Things were rougher back then. They had no intent of throwing stones at them when they got outside of the tent, because their goal was to get them wet. And that's probably what Mark and his friends were thinking when they unzipped the tent and tried to make a run for it. They didn't imagine they would be pelted by the stones, and the boys didn't plan on doing it. Except there was a blind kid among the kids throwing stones. I don't get that. One of the kids throwing stones was a blind kid, and you can imagine what happened next. Nobody told that kid that they were running outside the tent, and the kid nailed Mark right in the face with this stone.
It's worse than that. I was chasing after him, and he had one rock left in his hand. Running the other way, threw it over his shoulder.
Oh, okay. We tend to look at the David and Goliath story a little bit like that. You can imagine that maybe Mark is the giant, and the blind boy is David, who is just by blind faith slinging his stone, and just by chance and pure luck nails Mark in the teeth. But this is actually a stone I picked up in the Valley of Elah in Israel, where David would have picked his stones up. But a sling stone would have been bigger than this, probably about yay big, round and smooth. Nobody wants to have one of these jammed in their head. More than that, so let me read a verse to you from Judges 20:16 about the Hebrew slingsmen, specifically the Benjamites. They were among these soldiers were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. These soldiers were trained. Well, David was just a boy, But the same word used for strike when David is describing his attack against the bear is the same word used here. David was probably a trained slingsman. He knew what he was doing. More than that, King Saul later in this book describes David as crafty. He says, "Go and get more information. Find out where David usually goes and who has seen him there. They tell me he is very crafty." Well, that word in the Hebrew is the same word we find in Proverbs 15:5, which is translated prudence. A fool spurns a parent's discipline, but whoever heeds correction shows prudence, wisdom, craftiness. So David, he sees this threat, he picks up some stones, he slips them into his bag, and then he takes his staff. Well, Goliath doesn't see the stones. Goliath doesn't see the sling. He looks at the staff and he mocks him. "You're going to fight me with that stick?" "No, I'm not going to fight you with a stick. I'm going to fight you with these stones that you don't know about." And part of the surprise, because Goliath is expecting this traditional hand-to-hand fight, part of the surprise is when he pulls out the stones, when he slings it, and he does it so fast that Goliath is not even able to pull out his sword from the sheath. David was crafty. This was planned. This was deadly. Some of you remember the first Indiana Jones movie. Yeah. Indiana Jones is getting prepared to battle with this Arab person with a sword who slings it around, and Indiana Jones is holding his whip right here. And he reaches into his bag, pulls out a gun, boom, it's over. That's what's happening here. David was crafty. David looks outside of the box. So when Saul saw David, and he tried to put his armor on David, his misconception was that David was going to fight him the traditional way. But David had a different plan altogether. There's a famous song from Casting Crowns where they talk about this event, and they say, "Just a sling and a stone." It wasn't just a sling and a stone. This was like a machine gun to a knife fight. David was prepared. He tricked him. And like that, Goliath fell. And that's it. The kind of person that God is looking to prosper is a person who has the right motives, like David did. The person who is well prepared, like David was well prepared. And a person who thinks outside of the box. The right motives, good preparation, and thinking outside of the box. Now let's process those for just a minute. The right motives, as a body, as a church. So when we're thinking about, reaching people for Christ and helping them in their relationship with God, sometimes it can become about the program. We can get too wrapped up in it. Or sometimes we just want people to be here because it makes us feel good about ourselves. And because of that, we don't really reach out into the community. We don't really go out. We don't do it with the right motives. And it's a challenge for all of us at times to approach it for other people's sake, not just our sake, to think about it in terms of what's good for them. This is true in our marriages, too. A husband could say, I'm doing all this work for you, but is he really? Is he really doing it for his family? Or is he really doing it for himself? There's a popular TV show that was on a few years back, and the husband of this TV show went into a life of crime to pay for bills that he couldn't manage. And throughout the series, he kept saying, to his family, "I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for you." And the wife just couldn't stand it. Finally, in the last episode, he said, "I did it for," and the wife interrupts and she says, "I don't want to hear that you did it for us anymore. I can't take it." And then he finishes what he was originally going to say. "I did it for myself because I liked it." His character moment kind of became complete. He was really doing it for him. And sometimes it takes us a long time to realize all of the things that we're doing are really just for us and not for other people. Secondly, we need to be well prepared. God prospers people who are well prepared. And maybe some of you are thinking of those moments in the Bible where the Israelites acted in great faith, and like with Hezekiah when he was attacked by Sennacherib. And all of a sudden the armies of Sennacherib were just slaughtered in a moment. Or maybe you're thinking of the time when Gideon went out to battle and God said, "Nope, I want you to cut your army in half. I want you to cut your army again." And in these moments of great faith where people went out with little resources and did amazing things. But there's a lot of times in the Bible where people went out and had victory by using their hands and their skills, and they were prepared. And God does both. God does amazing things that draw wonder from us, and God works through very seemingly natural means like our hands and our feet. God does that, and we need to be well prepared in what we do. We need to think through what we do in order to prosper as a body in all of our relationships. But we also need to think outside of the box from time to time. You might be one of those people who are thinking, you know, I'm pretty much a traditional person. I'm comfortable doing things the way that they're normally done. And there is nothing wrong with that at all. If it works. In recovery circles, you'll hear this often. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Sometimes we need to think differently about a situation. Sometimes we need to think differently in order to prosper. We've tried to do this forever. It's not working. Why don't we try to do it another way? Is there another way that we can do this? And God's hand is upon that. It's wisdom. It's prudence. So what's this look like for us? What's this look like for us at work? Some of you may have been at work for a long time. Your coworkers know that you're a Christian, and it's just kind of the default. So you don't really do anything else to witness to them, or you just don't know how to witness to them anymore. You want to make an impact at your work, but you're just noticed and noted as one of those Christian people, and it doesn't seem like you have any room. Well, if your motives are right, if you're well prepared, maybe there's another way that you can show love to these people. Maybe you can show love to people by, if you've heard that one of their aunts have died, by writing a card to that person. Or maybe you've overheard something about a hobby that this person does. They like to sketch, and you buy them a set of pencils, something simple. Or maybe you show love in a creative and interesting way by just remembering their names, the names of their kids, names of their grandkids, showing interest in them. And you're not doing it just for a religious message. You want them to know the message about Jesus, but you do it because you actually really love them. You really care about them. We talked a little bit about, there was the survey that was taken by churches that had success with millennials, and they found the commonalities weren't facility, they weren't the hip pastor, thank goodness, they weren't the worship style, but they were warmth. It was warmth, the warmth of the body. And that gets me juiced and excited about our body, because that's a strength that we have. But the question is, how can we creatively leverage that strength to reach people? We have a strength. We're pretty good at it. But how can we become better at it? How can we leverage that? What are some creative ways that we can touch people in places where people aren't being touched? There's an adventure ahead of us, and it's really promising. Saddleback Church. It started, remember, with just 60 people. The product of 15,000 letters. You want to know the statistics on that? They got less than a half a percent of people to respond. But one of the people in that home group who were originally a part of that, they said this in hindsight. I really thought it was profound. "I think we were in the middle of a miracle, and we didn't even know it. I think we were in the middle of a miracle, and we didn't even know it. I think us are in the middle of a miracle. I don't know what it's going to look like. It may not be a lot more numerical growth. It may be deepening by the Spirit of God. I don't know. But I believe that we're in the middle of a miracle right now. We have a lot to leverage, and God's going to take us some really great places. Let's pray. Father, we want to be the kind of people you prosper. We want to have right motives. We want to always be questioning our motives and coming before you and asking for your help to reveal our motives to ourselves. We want to do things for the right reasons. We want to be well prepared because growth doesn't come about unless there's effort by faith in you. And God, we want to see those places where maybe we can do something different to be a part of what you're doing in this community and beyond. Southern New Hampshire, God, help us to be a part of that. Touch us in our relationships with family. Touch us in our relationships as a community. God, be with us in Jesus' name.